Blog Talk Radio.
Morning. Welcome to another episode of Masonic Home Companion. Wonderful time to be with you on this 6th day of January 2013. Chinese New Year's is coming up, not for a few weeks. It's on February 10th. This is going to be the year of the black snake. Kind of an interesting period. Year of subtlety, collectiveness, as all. It's a very positive year. It's a year of it's a yin sign of female animal. So I didn't know that Chinese New Year's goes on for 3 days. Chinese New Year's on the 10th of February. So a call out to all of you Chinese brethren. And then what's called Chinese New Year's second day on the 11th. And then, I love these guys, replacement day on the 12th. I don't know what they're replacing, but it sounds marvelous. Of course, we can take our hat off to the older culture and pay homage. It's an amazing time to be alive. We have... We have some readings and masonry. I want to talk with you a little bit today about changing time, changes that are occurring, and maybe a bit of an update or an opinion piece on the state of our great order. Who am I to say? I'm equally as equipped as anybody else to have an opinion, and that's all it is. When the fight begins within himself, a man is worth something. So said Robert Browning. There is no truer truth obtainable by man than comes of music. I would agree. It deepens the understanding of the human soul, human experience. I hope we talked about that a few shows ago. I hope you've... reflected a little bit on it. I came back yesterday from attending a ballet with my daughter. Tchaikovsky's piece, the seasonal wonderful piece, The Nutcracker. If you get a chance to see it just for the pageantry and the costumes alone, the story is relatively straightforward. It's wonderful. It's always little people crawling around a place. The only time you're likely to go to a ballet and see some of the patrons crawling up the aisles. It's wonderful, but the Four Seasons Center in Toronto is just it's a magnificent tribute to the arts. I hope everybody gets to see it. But the sound is amazing, and truly, when they say that the sound in the room is balanced everywhere, it's they're not exaggerating a bit. But The Nutcracker was wonderful, full of energy. Costumes, I love costume pieces, so. If you get a chance, it's not at all, nobody's going to feel out of place. The audience is quite diverse, and it's something that we can do seasonally. And the cost isn't prohibitive at all. This is an interesting day in history. So this day, January 6th in 1838, Samuel Morse demonstrated the telegraph. And very, very interestingly, on April 2nd, 1972, he died, a very wealthy and famous man. On January 7th, the first U.S. presidential election was held. That was in 1789. And on January 9th, 1493, Columbus mistook manatees for mermaids. Who knew? This is the, just in a few days, January 11th, Theodore Roosevelt made the Grand Canyon a national monument. And some of you will remember from the television program, I'm sure, and some of you from the original radio broadcast, January 12th, 1926, that went on for years. Amos and Andy debuted on Chicago radio. It's an interesting time. Hmm? Do you know on this day, New Mexico joined the Union in 1812. But Harold II was crowned England on this day in 1066. This is also the day, do you remember the figure skater Nancy Kerrigan? Somebody whacked her on the knee to try and take advantage. It was on this day in 1994. Man. And it was on this day that Washington set up winter quarters in Morristown in 1777. Yeah, that was definitive for our American brethren. On this day that John DeLorean, Back to the Future fame, he was born in 1925. So it's always an interesting time if you take a look. Masonic dates, of course. What could be? What would a Masonic Home Companion be without a sprinkling of Masonic information? Fun facts. Not much on the site I'm looking at. Not much going on the 6th of January, but on this date. On the 7th, in 1808, the Grand Lodge of Ohio was established. Now, I've been plagued by people telling me how wonderful the lodges are in Ohio. So that's part of why it's on my short bucket list to attend in Pennsylvania and Ohio and New York. Got to. It was on this date, January 7th, in 1785, that our notable brother, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, received his second degree. And on January 8th in 1844, or 43, you know how well those secretaries kept records. Oh, my. The Grand Lodge of Iowa was formed. Oh, for those who have cracked the binding of some of these books, January 12th, 1886, Quattro Coronati Lodge number 2076 was consecrated and constituted in London. It is considered by many, pick me. To be the premier Masonic research lodge in the world. Of course, we could, without being embarrassed or competitive, say that it's the standard that all research lodges would try to achieve. So 150 years on, let's presume that research lodges that we know and hold dear to us will achieve that kind of traction. Wonderful. In 1818, on January 12th, the Grand Lodge of Indiana was formed. You know that Masonry really took root enthusiastically across the Americas. One could say, and I've read some historians talking about this, that it was a way for, in spite of the political and ideological differences between Britain and the new colonies, that there was still a sentiment and a desire to maintain some contact. And what better? Apolitical and secular, Freemasonry offered that opportunity. Secular, I say advisedly, because always spiritually connected, certainly. So gives us just a little bit of a sense of what was going on around this period in Freemasonry. On January 2nd, the day that's just passed us recently, in 1901, U.S. President Theodore Roosevelt received his first degree in Manicuck Lodge number 806 in Oyster Bay, New York. So before I see you again, there probably I'll see you again soon. We'll be back, so I won't. On February 11th, 1988, a group of Masonic leaders met with President Ronald Reagan. Grand Master of District of Columbia presented him with a certificate and the Scottish Rite enshrined made him an honorary member of those bodies. Ronnie. Interesting guy. Interesting guy. Oh my, January 26th. We have to get ready for Robbie Burns coming up, don't we? On this date, January 26th, 1887, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was initiated. That was the same day earlier, 1866, Grand Lodge of Montana was formed. Anyway, Arthur Conan Doyle, love your work, Artie. Let's talk just for a second. First, how are you? I hope you're doing well. And I hope you've made a New Year's resolution. I'm reading that 87% of New Year's resolutions are a bust. They don't go anywhere. So I'm talking to the 13% out there that are connected with Masonic Home Companion who do make a commitment to their New Year's resolution. This year, unlike any other year before, it has to do with my health, mine. So join me. If you're saying, if I only had somebody to do the to commit and join me in the struggle, well, let it be me if you need somebody. We'll do this together. So far, I've got to get myself in better shape and touch wood. So far, I am. So little bits, little steps, big steps, but committed. And I'm more likely to let myself down than I am to let you down. So maybe that's revealing a little more than is comfortable, but it's true. I don't like letting people down. I like sticking to my commitments. Remember, John Keats, the Romantic period poet, said, "A thing of beauty is a joy forever. Its loveliness increases. It will never pass into nothingness." Well, I think that the initiation process of Freemasonry is a thing of beauty. Just in the same notion that that there are beautiful equations that come close to perfection. Fanatics have their dreams wherewith they weave a paradise for a sect. Keats wrote that in The Fall of Hyperion. Interesting poems. You might want to take a look at that. Might stimulate some of the gray cells. Have you noticed what's been going on around Grand Lodge? I hope. Amazing and encouraging things. I don't want to come across talking about Grand Lodge like I'm a milquetoast. I am just like you. I can look at things critically on all sides now, but I have a need, and I think many of us have a need, for our Grand Lodge to be successful. And I began to think about why it seems easier, as the more I know about Grand Lodge, to support the workings and to appreciate the effort. Truly, it's, I think, an incredible undertaking. I'd ask you a question like I usually do, try and find a question you can help me with. What would you do if you, for whatever reason, for a day, were in charge of our Grand Lodge? Magic, caprice, serendipity, but you were the person in charge. Would you feel responsible for everything? I mean, truly. Ultimately and nominally, you're the figurehead. You're also, in a sense, the representation of all that is Freemasonry, we could say, in its broadest definitions. The representation of authority. So that's really important for us. The connection with our Masonic root. The source of our authenticity as Freemasons. What would you do? What changes would you make? Well, it's easier to sit back, I would say, and I think we all could agree, and lob criticism at the people doing the work than it is to step up, park our emotional sensations on the curb and talk thoughtfully about what we would do to make a difference. Or would we change anything? If you're a bit like me, I think that Freemasonry is a process. It has to do with where we've been in our history. It is organic for me. It's constantly evolving. And I've brought your attention to the industriousness of Freemasons. Lodges and districts are busy with all kinds of things. And some of them make sense and some of them don't make sense at the time. And others blossom and some of them wither. But there's a never-ending source of change, of new ideas. Periods of stagnation? Okay. But they're periods of stagnation, not a state of mind. And there, we begin to examine them, and it wrinkles our foreheads, and there's tensions and pressures, and we begin to define it as a problem. And that's when we begin to start to talk about it, communicate. Remember, Browning, when the fight begins within yourself, then we become worth something. I'll paraphrase a little bit. So it's not that we point fingers. It's that when you struggle, what is the solution? Given all of the factors as they are, all of the elements, it's not like we can just pair a few off and make it a simple world. If I can change the orbit of the universe, then I can make the world a little simpler. Nope. All things being equal, what would you change? Well, I'm looking at what's been happening in the past 10 years. Communication has been the focus. And I think this is brilliant. Not that it ever was neglected, but there are other responsibilities and other distractions that kept our Grand Lodge and our leadership, our elected leadership, the people that you and I elected, busy. And I think always realizing the management board, very, very astute and diversified. Thank you very much. It's great to get better ideas, I think. Realizing that as you move forward, the famous something has to be done went with our order. And yes, we're not prone to doing things hastily, but neither are we prone to stagnating. My goodness, certainly not. So we see the change occur. We are in a period of communication, an age of communication, like nothing we've ever seen before, in a sense. And it presents us with choices that we didn't have before. Now, is there a right or wrong choice? Nobody can really tell that. At the time when you're making choices, or I am, or we're planning something, we can't predict the future. But we can try and cut our losses. We can try and learn from our mistakes or past history. We can listen to good advice. If somebody is making a reasoned explanation, we can examine options. This is what I think Freemasonry does. We can push, and we should push, to get the good ideas out there and see and consider thoughtful and reasonable options. And then decide from those which seems to make the best at the time, which is the best at the time with the information that we know. I would like, if it was me that was in charge for a year, to remind everybody that, to be cautious about our hindsight. Because if we knew today a year ago what we know today, we would be entirely different people. If we could predict the future, we would be living in an entirely different frame of mind, a different universe. I'd be driving a different car. So hindsight can teach us only if it's balanced, only if it's balanced, yin and yang, positive, negative, the valence is there, and only if we're receptive to all of the lessons, not just what we want to pick through. We're going to pick the red jelly beans out of the bowl. It doesn't quite work like that. The remarkable thing is that in this age of communication, our Grand Lodge has made some serious steps forward. And successive Grand Masters have helped us to get there. Thank you. Thank them. I don't know if they are told that. I hope so. I think so. I think they know it. More to be done always. You could say the same thing about you and I. Is there more that we could do? Yeah. But are we paying attention? Absolutely. around the fringe, we need to, we're showing, I think, more tolerance for people that are a bit agitated or excitable or, you know, temperamental, let's say. I think there's room in the world for that kind of person. But it's not distracting us from the work that has to be done. We're hearing more and more thoughtful discussions. Now, coupled with the growth in our awareness of communication is an expanding emphasis on education. And there's so many people involved and invested seriously with visions, some of them collective, some of them very much their own. As Browning said, in heaven I yearn for knowledge, account all else inanity. On earth I confess an itch for the praise of fools. That's vanity. Makes you think. He also said, I have dared and done, for my resting place is found. The C major of this life, so now I will try to sleep. Complete your work. We have work to do. Now, education isn't one-dimensional. But we're starting to talk about the basics at a high level, a very high level. There's basic core competencies, things that we expect. It's like driving skills, you know, or learning to fly a plane or learning to handle a violin. There's certain things that need to be done. And so we can encourage people that have those inclinations to help by organizing the learning for them. Showing them, selecting a palette for the student and not necessarily restricting it, but giving them that start, holding onto the bicycle seat until just to that moment when they're able to understand balance and motion and away they go. And where they go with that on that ride, anybody knows. It's up to them. So we have these opportunities. Now that's happening in a really wonderful way. There is nobody to tell. This is where there's no school marm over us. That makes it easier sometimes. But if we have a good mentor, I think that question is being answered now in a whole different way. We have access to mentorship like we haven't before. And we can find mentors that appeal to us. A mentor isn't a role in a lodge. A mentor is a personality and the chemistry that works with us. So is there one style that works for everybody? Don't feel bad if the mentors available to you aren't quite that fit. Keep searching. And the mentors themselves, being everything to everyone, probably a prescription for failure or feeling hurt. Remember, a gain is a gain, however small it might be. It's progress. Progress is the law of life. Man is not man as yet. Progress is the law of life. So we have to admit, we're seeing growth and change. Now, the exciting part, and again, if I was in charge for a day, I might ask, write down a question and ask everybody, in 5 years, where do you think we will be? And in 10 years, where do you want to be, Masonically? And I think that gives us, a bit of a roadmap. Where do you think we'll be and where do you want to be? Well, it really takes quite a cynical mind to say that we're going to be going down and spiraling down. That's like saying, you know, if a person dives in the deep end of the pool, that they're never going to come up. Okay, we know differently. Be patient. They pop up every time. So it's not necessarily something that we can refute, want to be cynical, I guess we do have our cynics, don't we? And the cynic can always, as we know, find validity, find evidence to quote prove his point of view. But it's one truth amongst many, and cynics rarely are able to inspire. I think as we move along, education teaches us to change our expectations of ourselves and improves the quality of expectations toward our leadership and our Grand Lodge. I think it's a way for us to begin to understand more deeply how we can contribute, how we can become part of the larger picture. It draws us, I think there's a gravity that draws us into the orbit of Freemasonry. If anything is part of the change of making a good man better, it was a part of joining something larger with a common purpose. If you're part of the, if you're, each of us was a key on a keyboard and a piano, how would it be if any one note declared that it was the only note, that note was more dominant than all of the rest? I don't think it would work, do you? I would also ask the entire order to about their curiosity. Aren't you curious to see, let's say that we looked at the workings of our Board of General Purpose, and we looked at the production of ideas from our Grand Lodge. And for, let's say, a 5 or 10 year period, we agreed to listen very carefully, to ask legitimately probing questions so that we understand the nature of the ideas, and that we support them when we're satisfied for the next 10-year period. Aren't you curious to think, aren't you curious about what we might achieve that we're not achieving today? Not that there's anything wrong, but aren't you curious? I would think that perhaps there's a lot of us that might say that's a bit breathtaking. But it's like saying, gee, I don't think I can ride that bicycle like those other boys can. You can't until you learn a few things, you're taught a few things, or you pay attention and watch. And then you do. You try. And you fall off a few times and you pick yourself up. Well, with our curiosity and support of Grand Lodge, we fall and falter. We have to learn. Our Grand Lodge is enormously patient with the process. And I think they do a wonderful job of showing us guiding us by showing us the attitude when something unexpected or unpleasant happens. It doesn't necessarily mean that we're faced with failure. It means that perhaps we go to ground and talk to other thoughtful Masons and we open our minds to different perspectives. We begin to understand. Everything that we do as Freemasons, brethren, I would suggest that I would apply this to you and all. When we're looking at Masonic work, we're looking at, you're listening to anything, you're reading anything, you're watching a bit of a ritual. Yeah, I like the ritual to be uninterrupted by silliness and giggling, and I like the ritual to be well performed so I'm not distracted by sort of a, I don't mean somebody that is temporarily distracted by the attention. We get that. But when we know that somebody obviously hasn't prepared, it's a distraction, and I seriously can't follow what's going on because I'm distracted by the person saying it instead of what he's saying and how he's saying it. So it's like sitting and waiting while everybody walks around. And there's nothing going on, waiting for somebody to walk back to his chair, up from his chair. It would be, Shakespeare would be a mess if we stopped everything with so and chopped it up so that we could wait for the actors to go from position to position in silence when the audience sits there silently. Well, years ago I used to watch the Old Boys start to become a bit agitated about it. And when they started to tell me that it had up to 15 or 20 minutes of just nothing time, I began to think like an old boy. Now I think I am an old boy. I get it. But anyway, that's not what my point was. The point I'm trying to make is that when we're experiencing this process, it's really important for us to consider what the material, what the idea, what the lesson says, what's the point of it, and what does it mean to us as individuals. Not everything means everything to everybody. But if we're sitting, going through the motions and not absorbing anything, and we watch a room where there's the audience, the lodge is excited, we might begin to reflect on why. Am I missing something? The aim, as Browning said, if reached or not, makes great the life. Try to be Shakespeare. Leave the rest to fate. Try. There may be that Shakespeare inside you. The aim, if reached or not, makes great the life. Tends to make some sense. Now, can we depart for a second? Do you mind? I'm still amazed. I do live in a world of genius, and I live in a world of experts. Everybody is quite prepared and able, thank goodness, to tell me how I should be living and what I should be thinking. But simple things still puzzle me. I still am. I'm reading. I haven't. When I finish, I'm reading a book by a woman by the name of Professor Hammond on. It's called Time Warped, so that I can understand a bit more about time and what it is, so I can talk to you about it. I'll give you in the next couple of weeks. I'll give you a review of that book as best I can and see what you think. But today I'm puzzled by stuff that's going on around. We'll come back to Higgs boson. That's major science of the 21st century. And if you're like me, I think I might have slept through that lecture on the particle physics. we'll do a refresher together. I'm trying to figure out what in the world these very bright physicists are talking about when they're telling me that roughly 70% of the universe is made up of dark energy. And dark matter makes up about 25%. And I guess, like everybody else, I'm wondering, where is it? That's a large amount of energy. And they're measuring it. Makes me think of some material that I've read about within Freemasonry about the different dimensions and this semi-permeable veil, this membrane that seems to separate us from other dimensions, even life and death. So it is fascinating. Again, if you have any insight into that, please please send your notes to Mason Without a Clue at lostinspaces.com. you'll be writing a lot, and you can help me a lot. I have no doubt you'll help me with the. I'm going to give you some fun facts. Do you know the New Year's Eve tradition of lowering the time ball on top of one Times Square? New York began in 1907. The ball was made from iron and wood then, and it weighed 700 pounds. Today, the ball weighs 11,875 pounds. I think it is made of crystal, and I think it's made by Cartier, but. Do you know that Ethiopia celebrated the arrival of the second millennium on 11th September 2007? The 7 to 8 year gap results from alternate calculations in determining the date of the Annunciation of Jesus. Who knew? Did you know that 88% of all New Year's resolutions fail, according to psychologist Richard Wiseman? He claimed that in the Wall Street Journal. anything written in the Wall Street Journal must be fact. Every year, 12% of people in Britain injure themselves opening a bottle of champagne. You don't open it with your teeth. You use the bumper of your truck. Corks can erupt at speeds of up to 60 miles an hour, and there is 70 pounds per square inch, for all your engineering types out there, of pressure behind each one. 12% of Britons injure themselves. Sorry, I'm going to have a sip of something. I do love a nice strong French roast. Anyway, until 1751, in England, Wales, and British dominions, New Year started on the 25th of March, which was also known as Ladies' Day. Hey, I guess they're talking about us. In Elmore, Ohio, the locals drop a brightly lit 18-foot sausage from the sky to welcome in the new year. Gotta be there. Social networking site Twitter groaned under the weight of 16,197 tweets per second at the stroke of midnight on the 31st of December 2011 in Japan. It's in Japan alone, causing the site to crash per second. Lovely. It's a wonderful way of communicating. 60% of gym memberships begun as New Year's resolutions go unused. Gym attendance usually reverts to normal levels by mid-February. And that's true. I can attest in past lives when I was working out 5 or 6 days a week. You can see that. One of Germany's most popular New Year's Eve traditions is to watch Dinner for One, an obscure 1963 British music hall comedy. The tradition has made it one of the most frequently repeated television programs of all time. And for our brethren in Johannesburg, residents of Hillbrow, a suburb of Johannesburg, celebrate the new year by throwing large appliances, including fridges, televisions, and microwaves, off high-rise buildings. Party on. Party on. Times are changing. I guess I'm not going to talk to you about politics. I'm going to talk to you right now about an observation. I hope you don't mind. Yeah, but I think it's an important observation. It has to do with what's changing. You know that you realize that we are a benevolent organization. We espouse pacifism. We look for the commonness and understanding of all peoples. And, you know, in the past, some despotic creatures have found us that kind of thinking was threatening. And sadly so, I think. But nevertheless, it's some of us think that it's really important. But one day, people's attitudes, we can change people's attitudes, help them to appreciate in their own way that we are what we are. But I just want, in the periphery of my vision, some things have been changing. And I think it might impact on that we may have influence in helping settle a bit of what could be a very contentious matter. A writer named Andrew Adonis recently wrote an article called Taming the Plutocrats. And he's talking about how there's been a separation between the rich are getting richer and the poorer are getting poorer. He said that in 2009, the Gates Foundation gave out $1.8 billion in grants to improve health in developing countries. If it were a state, it would be the world's 10th largest international aid donor. Its operations certainly resemble a state. Today, the top fifth, of course, we identify America as a capitalist engine. The top fifth own 84% of the national wealth. We've just seen that played out in the news. And the top 1% own nearly a third. So the big and undebated question is the compatibility of this plutocracy with modern democracy. Credit Suisse said, the past decade has been especially conducive to the establishment of large fortunes. Last year, the bank reported that the number of people with assets of $50 million or more was estimated at 84,700, of whom roughly a third had net assets of more than $100 million. Nearly half of them are in North America and a quarter in Europe. Mr. Adonis says, the failure of public policy to tackle the wider excesses of corporate greed, which create and sustain much of today's gap in wealth, is a defining challenge for progressive people for the next decade. Today's super-rich believe they deserve their wealth, like the 19th and 20th century British aristocracy who struggled so bitterly against the rise of democracy. They are constantly looking over their shoulder at those who are even richer, who make them feel almost poor. And they believe their income is highly vulnerable and under constant political attack. The plutocrats are fighting hard against the irreducible minimum requirements of democratic equality. This is where I think you and I, the Freemasonry, may have a bearing, an influence. Within the top 1%, the richer you are, the lower your effective tax rate, writes Freeland. All of this came about. We began to look at this when everybody was looking at the person, Mitt Romney's tax affairs. So this is nobody's growing horns in the tail here. This is things that are changing and we're noticing. So what bearing do we have in all of this? Well, this is not an easy question I ask you. What do we do? What in the world do we do now? So I think we don't live in a vacuum. We are taught, I think, and encouraged to exhibit and exercise our Masonic principles outside the walls of our lodges. So what do we do with the changing time? Will this affect will this create pressures on us different than we've experienced in the past? It might, I think. I don't think we're well equipped to ignore this. But c'est la vie. Such is life. Let's see if we can take on the challenge within ourselves. And that's when we become something. No finger pointing. It's how do we make a contribution? I also think that the time communication certainly is a way for us to break down these barriers. The way when we start to talk, we begin to define problems. Instead of becoming this amorphous issue or something troubling, we can begin to put some controls on it. And that's how we begin, as human beings, we begin to remedy and solve things. So let's see what we can do with that. I know that you'll give me all kinds of advice. I trust you implicitly. I was sitting in a bookstore the other day, and I know some of you cruise through used bookstores, and I found, believe it or not, a copy of volume 108 from 1995 of the annual or material of Ars Quattro Coronatum. And so I picked that up for just a few dollars. And I thought, better in my hands, and so particularly because I can't imagine some of this being much interest to people that aren't of the order. And I was fascinated by an article called The Origin of Species - the Freemason, and it's by our brother Richard Sandbach. And this was delivered in the Ars Quattro Coronatum on the 11th of May of 1995. He reminds us that the late Robert Rudyard, the late brother Rudyard Kipling wrote, I keep six honest, self-serving men. They taught me all I knew. Their names are what and why and when and how and where and who. These six serving men have guided me through many jungles and now pray their aid again for a journey back in time to search for the origins of speculative Freemasonry. It is, of course, unlikely that we shall ever learn how the species of Freemasonry in its modern meaning originated. That got my attention. That got me. Much research has been undertaken. Many words have been written and a great deal of argument. Some of it, very abrasive argument, has been heard on the subject. But a review of the evidence may now even suggest further possibilities or perhaps even probabilities. In doing this, it will be necessary to go over familiar ground. But as a lawyer, I have been taught to make no assumptions about prior knowledge, but to state my case fully and in detail. First, then, we must define the object of the search. And this brings us to the first serving man. What? In the second lecture of The Symbol of Glory, Dr. George Oliver, brother George Oliver, wrote, "What is Masonry? I could give 50 definitions." This paper must, however, be content with one. But in establishing that one, we must take care that while adequately specific, it does not unduly limit or extend the range of the inquiry, as in similar cases other definitions have done. I propose to adopt with respect and admiration the definition used by Brother Colin Dyer for his important paper, Some Thoughts on the Origins of Speculative Freemasonry, which was read in Ars Quattro Coronati in 1982, namely that peculiar system of morality veiled in allegory and illustrated by symbols, which has in the present day become an organization based on private lodges under the control and government of the United Grand Lodge of England. Let's extrapolate a little bit. This definition makes three things clear. First, that we do not necessarily imply a link with a pre-existing system, such as operative Freemasonry, whether in England, Scotland, or elsewhere. Second, that we are looking for the origin of something that which has not necessarily been deliberately invented, but may have just growed. And third, that the Freemasonry of today must be clearly traceable from whatever we determine to be the origin. Evolved. I like that. Before moving on, there is something very important. There is another very important matter of definition that must be clarified. The difference between two terms which have been used as if they were interchangeable, and that is non-operative and speculative. I like to think of this like the people referring to sitting masters. Doesn't really exist, does it? So the failure to distinguish between those two terms has given rise to confusion of thought. In this paper, non-operative means a man accepted as a member of a Masonic organization who is not by trade or craft a Mason, while speculative refers to a Mason, whether operative or not, who acknowledges a peculiar system of morality as an essential ingredient of the craft. The search is clearly rooted in history, and so in a context of time. This makes it necessary to establish a date from which to work, and so the next serving man to call upon will be when. We shall have to come back to the question of when Freemasonry, as we now know it, began to develop. For the moment, the question is, when did this acceptance of non-operatives begin? Until the appearance of Brother Dyer's paper, the dominant theory about origins was the transitional or direct descent theory, which Brothers Hamill and Gilbert, in their book World Freemasonry, explain in these words. The theory of a direct descent from operative masonry states that there were lodges of stonemasons which were units controlled by the Masons' trade. In the 1600s, these lodges began to accept men who were not stonemasons, calling them accepted masons. Gradually, these accepted Masons became the majority in the operative lodges and transferred them into speculative lodges. Many scholars today do not accept this theory. Brother Dyer firmly rejected it. But we must inquire what evidence there was to support it. The answer has to be very little. We know that in England, by the second decade of the 17th century, there was, within the Worshipful Company of Freemasons in London, a body referred to as the exception membership, of which may not have been limited to operative Masons, and that some Scottish operative lodges were occasionally admitting non-operatives to membership. There is evidence which suggests that some sort of rite of passage may have been practiced in some lodges in Scotland. But we know little or nothing which either explains the reasons for any extension or membership in Scotland or England, or confirms that there was indeed anything that could be regarded as a systematic transition of operative into speculative lodges in England. Further, though some moral and mythical instruction may have been sufficiently specific to be called, although some moral and mythical instruction may have been involved, there is no evidence at that time of anything in English or Scottish Freemasonry sufficiently specific to be called a system of morality. Although we know that English operatives met in lodges, we cannot, in the present state of the evidence, decide whether those lodges had a degree of permanence or only came into existence for a particular job. Though where the job was ongoing, as for instance at York Minster, an impression of continuity may come to exist. There were medieval statutes regulating the English Masonic craft, but there does not seem to be any solid basis for assuming that there was at any period any speculative element to that craft. However, in the 17th century, we have two markers, separated by a period of 40 years, which gave some evidence about the development of a non-operative element in Masonry in England. The earlier of them, it comprises the first firm evidence we have of the making, to use the term which seems to have been the most usual in early days, to describe what we now call initiating of non-operatives in an English lodge. When Elias Ashmole wrote in his diary for the 16th of October, 1646, words which he can hardly have expected would attract so much interest and comment more than 300 years later. Quote, I was made a Freemason at Warrington in Lancashire with colleague Henry Manwaring of Carnsham in Cheshire. The names of those who were then in the lodge, period. Mr. Rich Pinkett Warden, Mr. James Collier, Mr. Rich Sankey, Henry Lidler, James Ellum, Rich Ellum, and Hugh Brewer. The statement is important for two reasons. First, because we know a great deal about the man who wrote it, and have therefore a reasonable chance of assessing why he took such a step, something to which insufficient attention seems to have been paid. Even though we can hardly expect to understand how speculative Freemasonry developed, if we do not try to determine the motivation behind these makings, and second, because of the content of the entry itself. For the moment, there are only two points to make about it. First, Ashmole uses the word made a Freemason, the words, so that it would appear that these words had become technical terms by 1646. Second, the entry implies that some sort of ceremony took place. These two points suggest that by the middle of the 17th century, there was a recognized procedure by which somebody who was not a Mason by trade could be accepted as a Freemason, and consequently, that others had been so accepted. It is therefore natural to ask what sort of men were being made. And so the next serving man is who? Not all of those present when Ashmole was made were operatives, but there is presumptive evidence that at least one of them may have been. In an article published in 1989, Brother H. Boscow reported on his investigations into the identity of those who were present, and I gratefully acknowledge that the use I have made of that article in preparing this paper. Ashmole, the son of a saddler, was brought up in Staffordshire. At the age of 16, he went to London, and when 21 years old, in 1638, he had what he called an indifferent good practice in the Chancery Court, In that year, he established his connection with Cheshire when he married Eleanor Meanwaring, granddaughter of the former sheriff of the county. In 1642, he left London, where the early rumblings of what became the First Civil War were being heard. That was off of his head, Charles I, Cromwell, all of that. He supported the king's cause, and employment in the excise department brought him to Oxford, which was a royalist stronghold. He studied natural philosophy, mathematics, astronomy, and astrology at Brasenose College, and in December 1645 went to Worcester as a commissioner of excise and later became a captain in a regiment there, returning to Cheshire on parole when the city surrendered to the parliamentary forces in July 1646. On the 15th of October, he was made a Freemason in Warrington. Just over a week later, on his travels, he was returning to London. After the Restoration in 1660, he became prominent in heraldic and antiquarian studies and was a member of the newly formed Royal Society and founded the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford. That's where he gave all kinds of material that he had collected. An entry in his diary records records his presence at a lodge of at Mason's Hall, London, on the 10th of March, 1682, where William Wilson Knight, Captain Rich Borthwick, and others were admitted into the Fellowship of Freemasons. Later, he refers to the candidates as the new accepted Masons, rather different terminology, which reminds us of that body within the company, which, as we have seen, was called the exception. It seems clear that he was regarded as entitled to attend by virtue of his Cheshire initiation 36 years before. So here we have an important evidence that making conferred a widely recognized status within a guarantee of fraternal acceptance among others who had been similarly made. The other man made at Warrington at the same time was Colonel Henry Mainwaring, and that was Ashmole's cousin by marriage. A deputy lieutenant and commissioner of the militia. When the Civil War broke out in 1642, he had joined the parliamentary cause and, according to Bosco, was the most industrious parliamentary military leader of the parliamentarians produced locally until Sir William Brereton returned to Cheshire in the following year. However, he seems to have fallen out of favor with Parliament in 1644 and may have changed sides. We now come to those whom Ashmole listed as of the lodge. The first who seems to have presided was Mr. Richard Penkert, as noted as warden, which may imply a degree of stability for the lodge. The Penkert family were armigerous, and their seat was near Warrington. Their support of the royalist cause seems to have reduced them to comparative poverty. Nothing certain is known about Richard Penkert or Richard Sankey, except that they must have been Freemasons since Ashmole lists them as then of the lodge, or may have been a parliamentarian. We cannot certainly identify any of the remaining men so listed, but Bosco suggests that Mr. James Collier may have been another royalist. There are several points to note from this. First, Ashmole refers to those present that were then of the lodge, and this, coupled with the description of Penkert as warden, it's a bit of a spelling matter here, that's why they put this in a parentheses and make it a little bit difficult to figure out how to say it. This suggests that the lodge may have some sort of existence by then, though there's no evidence that it met regularly. And second, Brother Bosco has given us grounds for thinking that one at least of those of the lodge may have been an operative Mason, and that at least two were probably non-operatives and may have been royalists. And last, Ashmole was a royalist on parole in a part of the country over which the two sides in the war had fought fiercely, was in the company of a relative who may or may have not have been persona non gratis within the winning side, and was about to set out alone on a journey across the Midlands, a territory which, following the decisive defeat of the king's army at Naseby in June 1645 and the fall of Oxford a year later, was nominally controlled by the Parliament, but effectively by the new model army which Parliament was trying to recruit for service in Ireland or disband, and those and whose pay was substantially in arrear. The king was a prisoner held in ransom by the Scottish army at Newcastle-on-Tyne, and in London, whither Ashmole was going, the victorious and somewhat fanatical Parliament was heavily engaged in considering penal legislation on religious matters, even in some cases involving the death penalty for failing to accept its rigid doctrines as orthodox. The country was only one step removed from anarchy. Ashmole might well be concerned for his own safety on this journey. Even though Plot may have been somewhat gullible, we can accept as fact on this evidence that by 1686, a substantial number of men from the upper echelons of society had found it worth their while to seek to be made Freemasons, and can conclude that by the middle of the 17th century, any worthy man would not have found much difficulty in becoming a Freemason. This will lead us to another serving man. Why? In due course. But before we have a problem of definition to solve and must ask how, since we need to know what was involved in making before we can assess how it might impress and what it might achieve for men who sought it. How Dr. Plot was a contemporary of Ashmole. He seems to have been no friend of Freemasonry, but was clearly aware of it and had made extensive inquiries about it. He states that when a man was admitted into Freemasonry, a meeting was called at which the main business, after a collation paid for by the candidates, a burden which candidates seem to have had to bear in those early days, was the communication of certain secret signs, whereby they are known to each other all over the nation, but which they have maintenance whither they ever they travel. True, he goes on to make some highly questionable remarks about the duty of one Mason to come to another, quote, though from the top of a steeple, what hazard or inconvenience soever he run. But the fact remains that he clearly states that a main part of the ceremony was the communication of recognition secrets, which, when regularly given and received, to quote our present ritual, would entitle a stranger to succor and assistance. He also mentions, as important on such occasions, a large parchment volume containing the history and rules of the craft of Freemasonry. The volume mentioned is presumably that documentary history, as we may for this purpose so regard it, of Masonry, with rules for the conduct of Freemasons, which we know as the ancient charges or old charges, and which, as an antiquarian, Plot clearly despised. Though it will be noted that, busy about reviling its historical elements, he says little of its moral content. But the point here is not whether the charges were accurate records or not, but first, that their existence was prized by members of the fraternity, and second, that they were brought to the notice of newly made men on their making as important elements of Freemasonry. In assessing the weight to be attached to Plot's evidence, it is fair to notice that he appears in these respects to be supported by what we now know from other sources. We can reasonably deduce that in order to admit a man as a Freemason, a formal meeting had to be held, and certain requirements met, as a result of which the candidate would be made aware not only of the recognition secrets, but also of the ancient charges. Such a procedure would make the ancient charges items of interest to men so made, and that would help to account for the respect with which they were treated at the time when the first Grand Lodge was founded in 1717. We must therefore briefly venture into what has become for researchers a hornet's nest. Oh my. In his 1982 paper, Dyer examined the modifications which the ancient charges underwent in the 15th and 16th centuries, with particular reference to two of them, the Cook manuscript dating from around 1420 and the Grand Lodge No. 1 manuscript dated 1583. We should, however, note the tentative opinion of no less an authority than the late brother Dr. Stanley Aston, that the latter document may well have been antedated and rightly belong to the early 17th century, in which case it would have been written some 200 years later than the former. Dyer concluded that whereas the earlier document related to an operative craft, the other appeared to have been specially copied for a group or movement, moral in subject, which obviously had some religious significance. For the present purpose, the relevance of this is that the documents in use as ancient charges in the early 17th century could be developing in a way which would enhance their importance for men who were becoming masons for some purpose other than that of practical building. Further factors noted by Dyer show that this development continued into the latter part of the 17th century, and detailed rules called the New Articles for the acceptance of a man as a Freemason and for the practice of Freemasonry began to appear, the earliest known example being the Grand Lodge No. 2 manuscript, of which Dyer says it is provisionally dated about 1650, which could mean up to 20 years or so later. We may conclude that the importance for Freemasonry of the ancient charges, even in their revised form, had certainly not diminished, and had probably grown during the century, and that makings were increasing. If, as seems to be the general opinion, it was necessary to have a copy of the ancient charges at a making, and possibly to read it, then bearing in mind that early makings of non-operatives must have been conducted by operatives, this would reflect operative practice. On the other hand, the changes in emphasis which Dyer noticed could be consistent with the admission of non-operatives, and so may provide a clue to when such admissions began to be common. That would imply that the change took place over a period approximately from the mid-16th century to the mid-17th century, which would at least be consistent with the evidence already considered, though not conclusive. The new articles in the Grand Lodge No. 2 manuscript and the Harleian 1942 manuscript are clearly directed to tightening control of the conduct of men who have been or are to be accepted as Masons. We can note in passing that the London term acceptance seems to be displaced by the more rustic making. Dyer asserts that here is a Masonry that is recognizable as the forerunner of the modern craft, a forerunner possibly, but not necessarily an ancestor. And though it may be stating the obvious, it must be remembered that the motive for such action is almost always to import more discipline into a situation which is felt to be getting out of control or too lax. It seems a tenable hypothesis, therefore, that the growth of makings is relatively haphazard manner, was causing concern that the status of Freemasonry was being cheapened in that the privileges of membership were becoming too widely available. An interesting thought, as it may imply that there was some centralizing influence at work. The more we can say with reasonable certainty is that the new articles, with their emphasis on regularity, records, and secrecy, are exactly what one might expect to find in such circumstances. But there is no evidence as yet of any general or any formal association by non-operative Freemasons. We still have to establish whether speculative Masonry, Freemasonry, was an indigenous growth, the product of English minds, or something which the English adopted and molded to their own liking. Scotland can show earlier records of the admission of non-operatives into Masonic lodges than England can, and claims have been made which suggest that speculative Freemasonry may have originated there. So we now consider the next serving man. Where? To assess the importance of location in this inquiry, we must take account of the geographical distribution of the population of England in the 17th century. The Industrial Revolution would later bring a great increase in population to the Midlands and North, but before that, the mass of the people still lived in the South and Southwest. London was preeminent to an extent unknown before or since. It was the largest city in Western Europe, while the population of the whole country was some 6,500,000. This may be considered an injunction with Dr. Plott's statement of 1686 that the admitting of men into the Society of Freemasons in the moorlands of this county seems to have been of greater request than anywhere else, though I find the custom spread more or less over all the nation. At that time, England and Scotland were considered as separate kingdoms, so the phrase over all the nation can hardly include Scotland. The bulk of the population of England was clearly in the southern districts, so that one could look to London as the capital for evidence of the making of men as in any way universal, though the importance of Bristol must not be overlooked. Though we have no solid English evidence of operative lodges working ceremonies other than the occasional making outside of London during the 16th century, we can assume that the Guild or Company of London, known at the beginning of the century as the Fellowship of Masons or the Company of Freemasons of the City of London, was probably the precursor of the London Company of Masons. As noted earlier, it seems that we to have been admitting non-operatives into the exception in the first half of the 17th century. And we have also seen that the new articles in the charges use the term accepted. The suggestion of accepting a newcomer implicit in that term may mean that in this case the candidate didn't become a member and imply the existence of some sort of ceremonial rite of passage. But there is no suggestion or even a rudimentary system of morality. Nevertheless, we could find here a body on which efforts at maintaining standards and tightening control and discipline could be based, and which could form, as it were, a background against which an organized attempt to form an independent control could mature when the time was ripe. In Scotland, since the statutes at the end of the 16th century, operative lodges had been required to keep written records. These make it clear that Masons' lodges had a substantial degree of permanence, did not exist there, and that some did on occasion admit non-Masons to membership. Dr. Stevenson, who is not a Freemason but has carried out a great deal of research into Scottish Freemasonry, lists a number of cases of admission to non-operatives into lodges in the 17th century. But only in a few of them do the non-operatives seem to have been regular attenders or to have remained members for long. It is difficult to accept that such admissions in the 17th century arose from any other cause than the patronage which was so deeply ingrained in the Scottish social system, and perhaps curiosity about the existence of a Mason word. There does not seem to be evidence that anything more like speculative Freemasonry was involved or that Scottish practice spread south to England. We may therefore fairly presume that speculative Freemasonry in England developed as an indigenous social phenomena. The fact that Scottish emphasis on the word, quotes, contrasts with the English situation, except in the case of Randall Holm III. There's a note about that I'll read to you later, which seems to support. We can now return to the question we left outstanding under when. When did Freemasonry, as we have defined it, develop? There are two distinct stages to establish, and it is important not to confuse them. One is when did lodges begin to make non-operatives on a regular basis, and a theory about which has already been suggested, still leaving outstanding the question of the reason why such men would wish to become Freemasons. On the other, which must be tackled now, is when did men so, quote, made, start to meet together in lodges and evolve the system of morality, which grew to become the English speculative Freemasonry of today. And in this case, we shall have both the when and the why to establish. It is important to remember that Freemasonry as we know it is a social of social phenomena, and that therefore it must have developed in harmony with its environment, just as, if it is to prosper in the future, it must continue to do so. In the 17th and 18th century, there was great curiosity about every sort of knowledge and particular interest in philosophy and scientific matters. The modern map of heaven and earth took the shape which we now broadly accept only in the 17th and 18th centuries. Philosophy was a term used to cover a wide-ranging discussion about life and its meaning and purpose. The Royal Society was granted its first charter in 1662 and comprised a group of enthusiasts who were anxious to extend the boundaries of knowledge. Interestingly, from our point of view, political and religious discussion was not allowed at their meetings. Men of the caliber of Newton, Wren, Moray, and Ashmole were members, and with other similar groups made possible the birth of an era in which such men as Johnson, Burke, Goldsmith, Garrick, Boswell, Gibbon, and that inveterate gossip Horace Walpole could flourish. A mental fever of curiosity enveloped England in the latter half of the 17th century as the spiritual inheritors of the Renaissance eagerly resumed the quest for learning, which the quarrels of the disastrous first half of that century had interrupted. The Age of Reason followed, and its influence can still be seen in Masonic rituals. The Society of the Coffee House and Club held sway. Argument of every description flourished. If Freemasons, who were persons of the most eminent quality, such as Plot, referred to were in company together, it would be natural to discuss Freemasonry and the morality and history taught in the ancient charges. It has become clear that we have two questions to ask our remaining serving man. Why? The first we must ask him is, why did the early non-operatives such as Ashmole seek to become Masons? The answer to which we must seek in the 16th and 17th centuries. The second and easier one is, did such men turn their Masonic involvement into the system of morality we know today? And if so, why? In answering that, we shall also clarify more exactly when this development took place. So now let us turn to the last serving man. Why? It will be simpler to deal with the second of our two questions first, though that is the reverse of their historical order. If what we have already has been suggested is accepted, the answer to the question of why English speculative Freemasonry grew toward the end of the 17th century from earlier makings is clear. The inquisitive and social spirit of the age would ensure that men would gather together and discuss philosophical and scientific questions. When, on such occasions, two or more found that they had Masonic knowledge in common, it would be natural for them to arrange to meet privately to discuss Freemasonry. And at such meetings, when the conviviality of the inevitable feast was finished, what was there to talk about other than what they had learned when they were made, and perhaps their use of the recognition signs? The mythical history would, of course, get embellished, because it appeared to provide Freemasonry with a sanctifying cloak of antiquity. And the moral code would be embroidered and extended by reference to biblical exhortations, because the Bible was regarded as the ultimate and definitive authority in moral matters. With the example of the London Company before the inhabitants of the capital, the possibility of organization into coherent groups would be an obvious course. It requires no great imaginative leap to see that this, the start of such a movement as that which was developed into the English speculative Freemasonry of today. Such a theory would not run counter to a conclusion which Dreyer reached. In replying to the comments of his 1982 paper, he wrote, "Brother Carr claims that I have based my paper on the idea that there were but two phases in our Masonic history. Nothing is further from the truth. The paper is concerned to show that operative masonry had no part at all in the origins of the movement, which has become the English Freemasonry of today, other than the copying of some of its procedures and tools in allegory. That conclusion can nevertheless only be valid if there is some reason why men sought to be made Freemasons in the earlier part of the 17th century, and which would continue to engage their interests until the public emergence of speculative Freemasonry in some embryonic form. This implies something more than such things as idle curiosity, a wish to acquire spurious esoteric knowledge, a hankering after somewhat insubstantial moral teaching, or an interest in a mythical history of doubtful accuracy. After all, the makings continued over a considerable time. Had there been either no valid reason for their continuing popularity or a disappointment in what was achieved by being made, they would have ceased. And as Brother Seal Kuhn has pointed out, there must have been some compelling reason for such secrecy at an early stage for it to have had such a great impact for so long. We have come, therefore, to the outstanding question. Why did those early non-operatives of the 17th century and their successors, many of them apparently persons of importance, seek admission to groups initially established for and peopled by people, by men with whom they had so very little in common and who, however skilled, came from a different social background? Let me say at once that I do not believe that medieval operative Masons spent their time in esoteric argument and geometrical theorizing. They were practical builders, doing a construction job with the skill learned from experience, but they were not philosophers. There are, of course, those who would hold otherwise, but with respect, there seems to be neither reason nor evidence for their views. At this point, it will be as well to remind ourselves of the course of history in England in the 16th and 17th centuries. In 1550, the Reformation had been precariously established. A revision of Roman Catholicism followed under Mary, 1553 to 1558, after which Protestantism returned under Elizabeth I, and an attempted Spanish invasion was dramatically defeated in 1588, leaving the country free to develop its genius. When James VI of Scotland succeeded to the throne of England in 1603, he came from a country in which a Presbyterian system of Christian worship had been successfully established. His successor, Charles I, was an autocrat, whose policy on religion was suspect both for Episcopalians and Presbyterians. Civil War broke out in 1642. The king was defeated in 1646, the year of Ashmole's making, and executed in 1649. England came under parliamentary rule, at first that of religious bigots, who eventually, from 16th of December 1653, under the effective control of Cromwell, after wars in Ireland in 1649 and against the Scots in 1650 and 51 and the Dutch in 52 and 53. In 1660, Charles II was restored to both thrones. London launched itself into an era of scientific, academic, and social exuberance. In 1662, the Royal Society, which had existed in embryonic form since about 1645, received its first royal charter. In 1665, the Great Plague ravaged the country. In the following year, London suffered the Great Fire, and a revival of operative masonry followed as the city was rebuilt. Charles died in 1685 and was succeeded by his brother James II and VII, who was suspected of an intention to return his realm to Roman Catholicism and of a wish to restore the claims to absolute power which had brought his father to the scaffold. The West, the most densely populated part of the kingdom outside the London area, rose in rebellion, but was bloodily defeated. In 1688, James was forced from the throne into exile, where he and his family would be an ever-present menace to the peace of the country for the next half century, a menace which took the form of armed conflict in 1715 and 1745 and only ended in 1746 on the field of Culloden. It is against this political background of challenge, change, despotism, bigotry, and violence that our investigations are taking place. Before suggesting what we can deduce from the evidence, there are three failings to which I must admit. First, I cannot pretend to have the knowledge or technical abilities of such giants as Colin Dyer and Stanley Aston and the like. Second, I cannot accept any theory about the origin of speculative Freemasonry, which involves its deliberate creation at a finite time, since I am convinced that in such a case, there would be some evidence of that and none which I would accept as adequate that survives. And third, while respectfully agreeing with Brothers Dyer, Hamill, Gilbert, and others in rejecting the strict link theory, I have a gut feeling that we are trying to be too academic in our theorizing, and that the development may have been much more casual and indeed accidental than they and many others have suggested. My own explanation of this evidence, which in my inaugural address to this lodge on the 12th of November 1992 I described as heretical, is that against the background of religious and political quarrels which so bitterly infected 17th century England, to be made a Freemason may have been considered as providing an element of safety for travelers. It has been dubbed, not by me, the passport theory, and I would have not object to the name. This view will no doubt attract all the thunder and lightning to which heretics down the ages have been exposed, even when they are shown to be right. However, I think that a quotation from Thomas Burke's Travel in England is pertinent. Writing of Stuart times, he says, "The dangers of travel were so much recognized that any man going on a journey could, on request to the vicar of his parish, have prayers offered for his safety." In testing this theory, we have to rid our minds of the desire to set the solemn seal of antiquity on our origins, which has led some seekers astray. The inquiry is strictly limited by the terms of the definition of English speculative masonry adopted for this paper. It is therefore concerned in establishing whether the makings in the early part of the 17th century had any connection with the speculative Freemasonry of the early 18th century, and if so, how and why this happened. There is a clear link to the extent that the speculative Freemasons who practiced their craft in the 18th century made symbolic use of Masonic material in their rituals and had some knowledge of the ways of the operatives, as for instance in their regard for the modes of recognition and for the ancient charges. But that does not in itself prove that it was non-operatives who had been made Freemasons in the 17th century who created what was in effect another movement as the next century drew on. Nevertheless, when the atmosphere of the times and the social and political changes of the second half of the 17th century are considered, it seems possible, even probable, that links forged in the early part of that century in a search for security might well, as the apprehended danger lessened, lead groups to form clubs in which to share in the secrecy enjoined on them when they were made, both their experiences and the knowledge of Masonic tradition which had been handed down to them. It can surely now be thought of as doing much violence to academic aestheticism to suggest that they might even have some enjoyment out of mystifying those outside the charmed circle, a feature of human nature which researchers ignore at their peril. Nor would it be strange that there should be such a background in the existence of the London Masons Company. They should use the Masonic term lodge for their clubs. Lots going on, brethren. Thank you for listening. Thank you for tuning in. I'll be back. I think we've got something coming up in a week. And if I can, I'll slip in another program a little earlier. We have some guests lined up. I'm not going to give you out the names, until we have the dates and details firmed up, but I think you'll be pleased. In the meantime, I hope you enjoy yourself. I look forward to seeing you in Lodge and hope that you'll continue to commit acts of random Masonic kindness. Enjoy!